As all of you are aware, over the last 2 years, the world has been faced with a variety of natural disasters. Earthquakes in Japan, Haiti, Chile, monsoons, flooding in Southeast Asia, and even in the United States, we've encountered really severe weather. And the response, the medical response to these disasters is very important, very significant. And we'll be discussing our role in terms of Tikkun Olam and social responsibilities in responding to these disasters. What is really interesting from my travels across the globe is that this idea of global social responsibility is gaining a lot of prominence throughout various regions of the world. And of course, they turn to the Jews, to us, to give them guidelines on how to deal with the ethical issues. There's really very little one can say to introduce Rabbi, almost Dr. Kenneth Brander, to this audience. He is, of course, the inaugural dean of the Center of the Jewish Future, probably its main catalytic force, and has done a remarkable job in perpetuating its objectives, both nationally and globally. Rabbi Brander is the Rabbi Emeritus of Boca Raton Synagogue, who's the founding dean of the community, the kollel there, as well as the high school. And today, he was an alumni of Yeshiva College, received his ordination from Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Seminary in 1986, and he had the distinction of serving as a personal aide to the esteemed Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. He's also received special ordination from Mechon Pua, a center of medical ethics in Israel, and from the former chief rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu in the field of medical ethics. He is currently a PhD candidate in general philosophy at Florida Atlantic University. He is really a world-renowned speaker in numerous areas of medical ethics, and besides being a great thinker, nobody's more appropriate to think about a global response than Rabbi Brander.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a privilege to be here. First of all, if I may begin with thanking Daniel and Rachel once again for putting on a really wonderful conference with 60 other students. It's really a tribute to you. The only sad thing is you won't be frequenting our office as much. You might actually be going to class after today. So we'll miss you at the CJF, but you always have a place there. And I want to particularly thank Rabbi and Mrs. Fold, not only for making this conference happen, but when we started running the Medical Ethics Society and the Medical Ethics Conferences, I remember sitting in Rabbi Fold's office discussing the idea of allowing students to explore with intellectual integrity through the prism of Torah values, the ideals of what it means to be a citizen of society through the prism of Torah values, and he has been our major supporter in making this happen. We greatly appreciate that both of you have joined us and have really allowed so many of our students and so many of us to grow through your support and your benefaction. Thank you so much. Thank you. So hopefully you have handouts in front of you. Does anyone not have a handout? Anyone not have a handout? Okay. So I'd like to do the following for the next few minutes, and that is, I want to make sure it's the next few minutes. So I'd like to discuss an issue about the responsibilities, and it's so appropriate that we talk about this, the responsibilities that we have to be part of really three concentric circles, although we'll speak about just two of them. We as part of the Torah community, as part of the Jewish community, as well as to be part of the global society. We are citizens of the world community? And how do we balance the responsibilities that we have to help the Jewish community versus our responsibilities to be citizens of the larger society? And that tension, that paradox, is not a new paradox. In fact, it is introduced to us by Avraham Avinu, where Avraham Avinu uses the words, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, where Avraham says that I am a sojourner and a resident amongst the nations of the world, that I, in many ways, needs to be a citizen of society and engage within the world to help deal with the ills of society, but at the same time, I am a ger, I have a responsibility of recognizing and retreating to our own unique, special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our own unique engagement with the world. And so that paradox has really been part of our genetic makeup since Avraham Avinu. So I'd like to discuss how the Rishonim and others have dealt with this paradox, and hopefully it will shed some light on how we should deal with it. So if you can open your handout, we're not going to go through all these sources. You can view it as a little bit of homework. We'll go through maybe five or six of them, but we'll show different perspectives on this issue. We start with the Netziv, who has a wonderful introduction to Sefer Bereishis. Hopefully all of you are familiar with this Netziv. If not, it's worth coming just to hear this Netziv. The Netziv shares with us the idea that Sefer Bereishis is known as Sefer HaYashar. It's known as the book that deals with people of integrity, people of yashrus, of righteousness. Or maybe righteousness is not exactly the right word. And it speaks about the idea that the Avos are not called Hasidim or Tzadikim. The focus is not on their piety, but rather on their integrity. And the Netziv wants to understand exactly why this Sefer Bereishis is known as Sefer HaYashar. And the Netziv explains very beautifully the idea in very, very dramatic tone. He says that this is to explain the challenges that often happen to even the most righteous amongst us. And I'll read some of his language. Where chashdu et mi shera'u shenoheg shelo kedatam b'yirat Hashem shut tzeduki apikores, that when we are involved as Torah Jews in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we see other Jews that do not celebrate the same relationship with God, we call them names, apikoresim, tzedukim, maybe even worse than that. Uva ayidei zeh v'dei shvichus damim. And that lack of respect, that lack of tolerance of other Jews is what caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It was not that people weren't studying Torah. It wasn't that people didn't have a strong relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The challenge that caused the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash was simply because people did not respect each other. And he says, "Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Yashahu, God is straight. Ve'eino sovel tzadikim. He cannot tolerate even the righteous who, in the name of God, attack other Jews who do not engage in the Jewish experience the same way they do." And he writes, "Dezeh garam churban habriyah. This causes the destruction of creation, harisut yishuv haaretz, the total destruction of the inhabitants of the world." And the reason why the Avos are called Yashar is because they got that. Because look at the Avos. They had the ability to engage in a relationship with all of humankind. Abraham even protects Sodom, tries to stop Sodom from being destroyed. And therefore, says the Netziv, we are reminded through the values of our Avot and our Imahot, in the way they engage with others, about our responsibility to engage with all humankind and to treat all humankind with respect. So first we start off with this introduction of Bereishis that reminds us that it's Avraham Avinu who deals with stone. It's Avraham Avinu who welcomes who he thinks are three idol worshippers into his home. It is Avraham Avinu who teaches us this responsibility to be a citizen and to treat others with respect and to help others. It is continued through other personalities in Tanakh, whether it is the story of Yonah, or whether it is the fact that if you read through Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofarot, you'll see that in the davening of Rosh Hashanah, there is so much of a conversation about our responsibility to the rest of the world, that the Chafetz Chaim is known for saying that if the Goyim would know how much we speak about them, and how much we speak about our responsibility to the nations of the world, the Chafetz Chaim wrote that they would print the Rosh Hashanah Mavzer. And indeed, this idea is highlighted also by Rabbi Soloveitchik. In source number 2, Rabbi Soloveitchik says this in many places, but in source number 2, where Rabbi Soloveitchik clearly articulates his concern about interfaith dialogue, about not dealing with other faith systems on issues of religion, he also reminds us of our responsibility to be engaged within the world. And Rabbi Soloveitchik writes the following: what is the nature of these instructions? Our approach to and relationship with the outside world has always been of an ambivalent character, intrinsically antithetic, bordering at times on the paradoxical. We relate ourselves to and at the same time withdraw from. We come close to and simultaneously retreat from the world of Esav. When the process of coming nearer and nearer is almost consummated, we immediately begin to retreat quickly into seclusion. We cooperate with members of other faith communities in all fields of constructive human endeavor, but simultaneously with our integration into the general social framework, we engage in a movement of recoil and retrace our steps. In a word, we belong to the human society, and at the same time we feel as strangers and outsiders. And if you look at the last sentence, you'll see our patriarch Avraham already introduced himself in the following words: Ger v'toshav, I am a stranger and sojourner with you. Is it possible to be both Ger v'toshav? And Rabbi Soloveitchik explains, is not this definition absurd, since it contravenes the central principle of classical logic that no cognitive judgment may contain two mutually exclusive terms? And Rabbi Soloveitchik ends the piece that we read: and yet the Jew of old defied this time-honored principle and did think of himself in contradictory terms. We live this healthy paradox. He knew well in what areas he could extend his full cooperation to his neighbors and act as a toshav, a resident, a sojourner, and at what point this gesture of cooperation and goodwill should terminate, and that he must disengage as if he were a ger, a stranger. This is the philosophical structure, and what I'd like to do for the next few minutes that I have is just highlight some of the halachic issues. And first, to highlight the idea that the Gemara tells us in Gittin, the responsibility, mefarnesim aniyei nachrim imaniyei Yisrael, the responsibility to help both Jews and non-Jews, the responsibility to help in all different ways both Jews and non-Jews. And there is a series of Rishonim that look at this in a defensive posture. They define the words mipnei darkei shalom as if we don't want to create the enmity of the non-Jews upon us, and they take that perspective. And to be intellectually honest, we need to recognize there is a series of poskim that follow that structure in the way we engage with the non-Jewish world. So for example, I for your perusal, I show you in source number 4 the commentary of Rav Samson Rafael Hirsch on Pirkei Avos. That's source 4C, focusing on the statements of 4A and 4B. If you turn to the next page, you'll see a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which highlights the same idea, that our responsibility to help non-Jews is almost a defensive posture to make sure that the non-Jewish community doesn't think bad of us. The Chassam Sofer, when it speaks about, this is a very interesting Chassam Sofer, one that is taught in a more, when one has conversations about religious Zionism, this Chassam Sofer, there aren't too many that come up in conversations about religious Zionism, of the Chassam Sofer, this happens to be one of them. speaks about the whole notion of engagement when we live outside the land of Israel. And you have source number 7. You have the halacha that is found in the Shulchan Aruch. Umefarnesim aniye ove kechavim im aniye Yisrael. We have the responsibility of taking care of the non-Jewish poor with the Jewish poor, the non-Jews in crisis with the Jews in crisis, mipnei darkei shalom. And here you have the Mordechai, one of the Rishonim in the Gemara in Gittin, who says, and limits it, he says, understand what the Shulchan Aruch is saying when it says the word im, with, is to understand that you're only permitted to help non-Jews only when both Jews and non-Jews are simultaneously in the same tragedy. If non-Jews are in their own tragedy, there's no halachic obligation to help them. It's only in a situation in which Jews and non-Jews are together. And then you have the Sefer HaChinuch, who uses the language of the Gemara and says, Shemutar, source number 9, Lefarnes Aniye Gayim. It's permitted. It doesn't even seem like it's mandated. It's permitted to help non-Jews. But then, and while that, it is important to mention that this is a posture, a strand that is found within the commentators, and one could suggest that the reason why that strand is there is when these commentaries were written, it was a time in history in which the relationship between the Jewish community and the larger community was in a challenging state, even more challenging than it is now. But then you see a strand of poskim, a significant strand of Rishonim, who mandate the responsibility of engaging to help the non-Jewish world, not as a b'di'eved, not as a defensive posture, but as a mandate of what it means to be a Torah observant Jew. The responsibility to engage to help the non-Jewish community as part and parcel of our mandate of imitatio Dei, of imitating HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mahu Rachum, Afata Rachum. And indeed, if you look at the Shach in source number 10, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, where he very clearly says, Lav Dafka, source 10 again, it doesn't mean Im Aniye Yisrael, it doesn't mean that only help non-Jews when they're in the same tragedy as Jews, Lav Dafka, Elafilu, Aniye Obikachabim, Luchud. Even if non-Jews are just are unfortunately dealing with a tragic event, we have to help them. And the Shach quotes the Ran, the Rishon, the Ran. The Rashba in source number 11 says the same thing. It does not make sense to me, says the Rashba, that one should think that we only help non-Jews when you're helping Jews at the same time, but rather it's a mandated responsibility to help the non-Jews because we imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'racham Avakol Ma'asav, that we have a responsibility to treat all human beings with respect. And indeed, the Ritva says the same thing in source number 12. However, the source that I'd like to share with you and spend a few of my concluding minutes on is really the source number 13. It's the sources of the Rambam. It's a personal conversation that I had with Rabbi Soloveitchik that he shared with me on these sources that I think is important really to understand. Rabbi Soloveitchik highlighted to some of us, we had the opportunity when Rabbi Soloveitchik was at Yeshiva University, he used to sometimes give major classes, as Rabbi Tendler and others can tell you, including in this lecture hall, in which the place was filled, flowing into what we now call the old Beit Midrash. And then one night a week, there was a few of us who learned with him in the apartment in Morgenstern Dorm. And one day we were discussing this issue, the responsibility of helping non-Jews. And Rabbi Soloveitchik looked at these two Rambams in source 13. The first Rambam really is where the Shulchan Aruch gets its language. The Shulchan Aruch many times cuts and pastes from the Rambam. So in source 13a we have Mefarnesim, when one should help, one should clothe, Aniye Akum, non-Jews, Im Aniye Yisrael, the same as one or with Jewish poor, Mipnei Darkei Shalom, because of peace. But then in Hilchos Melachim, when the Rambam quotes the same idea, he says something, he elaborates upon it. Source 13b. Is everyone with me? Everyone with me at source 13b? Because this is the critical point. He says the following. Even non-Jews or even idol worshippers, the Chachamim said we have to visit their ill, we have to help bury their dead. In Meisei Yisrael, the same way we bury the dead of Jews, Ulefarnes Aniyehem, we have to help deal with their poor, Beklau Aniyeh Yisrael, as we help Jewish poor, Bipnei Darkei Shalom, because of Darkei Shalom. That's no different than you see anywhere else. But then the Rambam adds two psukim. Harei Nemar, Tov Hashem, Lakol V'Rachamav, V'Kol Ma'asav, that as we see in the pasuk, that God is good to all and His mercy is on all of His creations. But Nemar, and it also says, Derecheha Darchei Noham, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ways are ways of pleasantness, V'Chol Netivoteha, and all of God's paths are paths of Shalom. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, why does the Rambam need to add these two psukim? Why is it necessary? These are not two psukim found in the Gemara when this issue was discussed. Is there a specific reason that the Rambam felt it necessary to add these two psukim? Is there a message that the Rambam wants to communicate? And Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that the Rambam is trying to make a point. You can define the words Darkei Shalom to mean, for the sake of peace, that there shouldn't be enmity between Jews and non-Jews. Or you can look at the words Darkei Shalom and translate them differently. Shalom is a name of God. Why do we have the responsibility of helping non-Jews? Says the Rambam. Because we are v'chol netivoteha shalom. Because we have to imitate the ways of God. The reason why the Rambam brings these psukim down is because the Rambam is trying to accentuate a point. We help non-Jews not because it's a defensive issue, not because we're worried about Ma Yomru Hagayim, what the Gentiles are going to say. We have a responsibility of helping non-Jews because we are God's junior partners in fixing this world. And part of fixing this world is helping all of humanity. The reason why the Rambam adds these two psukim is to remind the readers of the Mishnah Torah that it is not a bidyeved but a lechatchila to engage in the responsibility of being citizens of society through the prism of Torah values. It is derecheha darchei noham, it's v'rachama v'kol ma'asav, it is because we have a responsibility to all of the world. That's the darkei shalom. It is the idea of imitating God that mandates our responsibility, not a bidyeved, but a lechatchila. And the Rambam continues to highlight that idea in the Shaila and Tshuva in source number C. And I conclude with just sharing with you a letter that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote. This, I did not have it typed up. This is his personal handwriting, where Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in a letter, highlights the responsibility of all Orthodox Torah observant Jews to make sure that they allocate funds within their tzedakah to help the larger world. He quotes the famous Meiri that is found throughout Avodah Zarah, that a non-Jew that is even involved in a crude form of monotheism has the din of Reacha, is to be treated as a friend and is under the category of Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha. So you have Rav Aaron Soloveitchik really demonstrating this in very definite terms. And so, I leave you with the following idea. In a world in which we as Torah Jews have to make sure that our day schools survive the financial challenges of the times, in a world in which community is going through difficult struggles, in a world in which the best form of birth control has become day school tuition, we have a lot of challenges within the Torah community. And we have a responsibility to first and foremost deal with those challenges. But in the process of dealing with those challenges, we cannot ignore another part of the meta-narrative of being a Torah Jew. And that is the responsibility to help society around us. And even though the bulk of our time may focus on the Jewish community, we still have a responsibility to make sure that we're there as citizens of the larger community, to follow the message that the Netziv tells us, that Avram Avinu mentions, the message that is found throughout the Rishonim, the responsibility of Mipnei Darkei Shalom, because we imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of being involved in guaranteeing the betterment of the world around us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brando. Our last speaker is Monty Goldstein. I've had the privilege of speaking to him a few minutes during this conference, and it's quite clear that he has unusual insights in both the medical, political, and global issues that are involved. He's been on site in various number of these disasters and offers a lot of very interesting perspectives that I hope he will share with you today. So, Monty Goldstein, he graduated from Ahon Lev College in 2005 with a BA in Business and Marketing, and he served in the elite unit of the Israeli Defense Force and became company commander of a reserve unit, a position which he holds to this day. He's also the CEO of Israel Care, and he's developing plans for a large organizations as part of preparedness for disaster, mass casualty events, and he's been doing this since 2006. For the last 12 years, he's worked as an EMTCC for Magen David Adom in Israel, and he has participated in many national and international medical emergencies. I think you could probably spend the whole afternoon sharing with us what he is, some of those experiences. They were, the few that he shared with me were fascinating. He's also served as Chief Officer of Zakai, International Rescue and Recovery Team. And in this role, Monty Goldstein has been in charge of training teams around the world to respond properly to terror attacks or to any disasters in their communities. Over the years, he received numerous awards because of his excellent devotion in the field of emergency medical services and disaster responses. Let's give him a big welcome.
Thank you very much. Where to start? Okay, so Zaka International Rescue Unit. Our goal is to save lives. To save lives, doesn't matter where we go and what we do. Our main goal everywhere is to save lives. And when we finish the stage of saving lives, the next stage we go to is honoring the dead. And I'm saying this because part of the International Rescue Unit, what we do is train communities around the world and teams around the world to respond to terror attacks or to big disasters. Those are the skills we're looking for. If somebody wants to come and save lives, if somebody wants the opportunity to come and make a change, you can come to us. What I'm going to speak in the next 10-15 minutes is about what the doctor tried to speak before and you didn't really hear, and I also have pictures from there, is the disaster of Haiti, and how a lot of people ask me, why are you going to Haiti? So far, there's no Jews there. How are you going to get there? It's very dangerous. Why? So I hope in 10-15 minutes you understand why. And let's go start and roll. All right, so Haiti by us started a couple of days before. The headquarters of Zaka in Israel and the police in Israel got a call saying that a chopper crashed in Mexico with five Jews, and they're having problems with the remains, and they want the team to go out there. And we had a whole discussion in the headquarters, if we have to go, if we don't have to go. Mexico is a big country, what can we help? And then we decided we're going out there. We spoke with the Rebbeim in Israel because they had a whole issue that they didn't want to bury the bodies. And we told them, listen, first of all, you bury the bodies because we already identified them. And we'll come and we'll try to help with all the other issues that they have. So we went out there and we get to the scene. And the first thing we see is a very, very big chaos. The police come to us, the fire department comes to us, they say, listen, we're missing a lot of things, we don't know what to do. can you please help us? So we said, for sure. What does that mean? It's a privilege for us to come and give you the skills. We have skills from all the bombs and all the big things we see in Israel, and we're here to give them to you. We're not here to keep them. So we divided ourselves into teams, and in each team we put our couple guys from the teams from Mexico, from the Jewish community, and two or three guys from the Federal Police of Mexico, and two or three guys from the firefighters in Mexico. And after 2 or 3 hours that we're doing search, one of the guys sees that there's all kind of remains on trees, and the firefighter comes to me and says, you're going to go up there? I said, for sure. Why are you going up there? I said, what does that mean? We got to make sure that every piece of remain gets to the right place, and every piece of evidence that we need, we should get. And there was a whole big tumult there of to do it, not to do it, a big discussion with the police department and the fire department. And at the end of the day, they understood that not only remains we can find it, but a lot of things that are a part of the crash can really help. Another main thing that we had in Mexico was the police department, the federal police, and the firefighters always wanted to hear more about the skills and the way we work. And in the evening, I sat with the Jewish community in Mexico, and I gave them the whole deal of what we did in that day. And the rabbi there told me, Mati, it's very, very important that you should go and speak with the police department and the fire department. I said, why is it so important? We finished our job already, and we're here to do a debrief with the people who went and helped us. And if I'll have time tomorrow, we'll go do it. It's not the main thing. He said, no. You don't know what's going to be for the Jewish community, and you don't know how they're going to react to us if you go and give them what they want. I said, you know what? Fine. It's 10 o'clock. If they're willing to meet me at 10 o'clock, I'm willing to go. And I went with my colleague Dovi, and we had a meeting there at 11 o'clock at night, and they started asking questions. They said, why did you come from Israel? So we asked. And how come you let our people work with you, even though we're not colleagues? So I said, listen, we have one goal. Our goal is to save lives. And if not, make sure the remains are going where they have to go. And if your guys now stay with us the whole day and learn how to do it, the next time you'll do it without us, that's great. The same conversation we had with the firefighters. And we understood from them that it was they were very amazed. How come somebody's willing to give part of their technology, call it, or part of their ethics to other people? And we didn't really, my colleague and I didn't really think it was something very, very important. The day afterwards, we thought we're going home, but Haiti happened. There was an earthquake in Haiti, and we got a phone call from Israel saying, listen guys, you're already in Mexico, and you're going to probably be the first team out there, and you've got to go out. And I asked my colleagues in Israel, I said, okay, what's going on there? How many Jews are injured? What's the security issues there? Who are we going to meet there? They said, listen, there's no one to meet. We're not sure there's Jews there. We know one Jew that's supposed to be in one of the houses there, but we really, really want you guys to go out. I said, you know what? If that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do. Now you have to understand, most times that we go into disasters, we have all our equipment from Israel. And here, we just came for a very small disaster. But, you remember last night, we spoke with the police department and with the fire department. So, as very nice Israelis, we went back to the police, the federal police, and said, listen, last night we guys helped you, and now we have some issues that we have to get to Haiti. And we know you're going to send an airplane there in a couple hours, and we want to be in your airplane. He said, listen, you know, you're Israelis, maybe American citizens, but going on a Mexican airplane, it's not the Mexican army airplane, it's not so pushy. He said, listen, oh, so yesterday your friend that wasn't so pushy that we gave you all the skills, so make sure we're on the airplane. And by the way, if you see, Mexico is much closer than Haiti than Israel. You can see it here on the side. And after a couple hours convincing them that it's going to really help them if we go out there, because we already were in all kind of other disasters in Turkey, Katrina, all kind of the tsunami. So They got convinced. A little bit of about Haiti. If people don't know, there was a very big problem before the earthquake. They were fighting there between them already for a couple of years. There's no army there. The UN is in charge. A very, very poor place. Not the place you want to go for vacation. Alright, here I have a little video. I hope it's going to work. For the first 2 minutes of the earthquake, exactly what happened. And I'd like to share it with you, and then we'll continue. I don't know if you can see, but if you see in the back, you'll see the houses from left to right are going to fall. All the houses in the back. That's from a camera, a speeding camera. And here you're going to see that the dog identified the earthquake like a couple seconds before. Picture of Haiti when it happened. They claim it's the end of the world. You see, there's all rubble, you can't see anything. This is one of the amazing things about Haiti. They were a couple minutes after the disaster, people were not screaming, everybody's trying to help each other. Usually we know a lot of panic, people are running, they don't know where they're running here, people are trying to help each other. Something that when we went out there afterwards, we saw how nice those people are and how much life value they have. You see here that they're trying to help each other getting out of the rubble. A bit about Haiti. The doctor tried to give you the numbers, but we didn't hear him the best. So there were 150,000 people that died in the Haiti earthquake. There were 2 million people that lost their homes. And you have to understand that there's no army there, and they don't have the money. And even if you really want to help them, you bring all kind of delegations from all around the world, it's going to be very hard helping 2 million people. So like I said before we saw the movie, we got our permit to get out there with the Mexican team. And we got out with the Mexican team. It took us a couple good hours to get there. Everybody tried to get to Haiti the first day. They couldn't because the airport was just crashed. So they sent us to an airport right there near there. And we had tried to convince everybody that we got to get there first, and everybody just told us, you know, you're 4 guys in Israel, alright, you're all guys, elite units, whatever, but what can you do there with your hands? So I said, let us just get on the ground, because we think with the skills we have, we can help. Another very important thing that we always say, every disaster is a chaos, and we're trying to make sense of the chaos. Therefore, if we get there, as soon as we can get there, and make sure that the people lead the chaos the right way, it'll be much easier. Okay, we land in Haiti. We don't have any cell phones. There's no TV, no radios, nothing. We can't use all kind of technologies we have in our equipment. And it's very, very difficult. We realize we land in one of the most hard events that were in the last couple of years. The only people that came in the first day were 3 delegations, England, Mexico, and Russia, and the United States Army. Our main goal was to throw all our equipment somewhere and try to get out there. Now, the main problem that everybody had there, and soon we're going to show you this also in the pictures, people didn't want to go out because the teams came, and they got to Haiti, and then they understood that there's no army here, and that the UN has to guard you, and in order to come and help other people, you gotta be really secured, and whoever works with search and rescue is not so affiliated with that. people that are not used to working with bodyguards and guns and everything. And it was very, very scary for a lot of people. By the way, this is the airport. You see all the delegations, everybody's in tents, right by the airport. And that was the only place that was safe for all the teams, because out there was a war zone. So this is a satellite picture of Haiti. And as you can see, the airport is really far from the university. The university is a spot that we chose to take because we understood it's very far. A and B, right near the university, there was a hotel that we were told that also Americans and also Israelis are there, so we wanted to get the closest that we can get. Once we got out there, so we, like I said, we tried to work together also with the Americans and also with the English and the Russians, and we all had one goal. A is to try to understand how big the chaos is, and B, to try to save lives. As we know, in all those big earthquakes, we have up to 4 or 5 days to save lives, because after that it's very, very complicated. Like I told you, the teams go, guard with the UN, jump on one of the trucks. They have people that make sure that you're secure and you go out there. This is another movie. I'm not going to show it because it's long, but we were driving from the airport to the university for about 25 minutes, and you just don't understand what's going around you. Everything is quiet. People are trying to help each other. People are screaming at us. Listen, we have people here that are alive. Why aren't you stopping? Why aren't you helping? By the way, when we came back to Israel, we had a very big halachic conference with all the big rabbis in Israel. What do you have to do? People tell you to stop because they have people here that are alive. Do you stop and help them, or you go to your mission and help some more people? A lot of halachic issues that now is not the time to run them all. So like you see here, it was a very, very big earthquake. And we get to the university. When we get to the university, we have one main problem. We hear the people that we're supposed to save. The Mexicans say that it's too dangerous and that they want to go back. Because they're starting to hear all kinds of shootings. Like I said before, Haiti wasn't the safest place. And a lot of people got the hint that they're not going to have food and water, and they were start shooting each other and all kinds of big places in order to make sure that they have their water and food. And we decided to stay. We decided to stay because we heard the people there. We heard people that are alive. So this is pictures from the university. It was a 7-story university that was what was left of it. And after a couple hours of working, we really get two ladies out of there. And the Mexicans, there were only 5 Mexicans that stayed with us, although the people, like I said, left. This is one of them. This is the second one. Then we went back to the airport, and the Mexicans are coming and saying, you guys, you're nuts. You're here to help each other. You're here to come back safe home. Why did you stay? Why? We're a team. We got to gather together. And we had this whole big tumult that night, and we tried to explain to everybody that it's right. You have to be very secure, and you have to go by the rules. But the rule said that you have to be back at 4 or 5. It didn't say that if each bullet you hear, you have to come back. Then Shabbos was something very amazing. Another question that we had when we came back to Israel. We worked on Shabbos there. We also rescued a couple people alive. There was a big halachic question. Okay, you knew there's only going there, no Jews. Why did you go out there and work on Shabbos? But maybe next year we'll have a topic about that. The Israeli army came. What the doctor tried to say before is, big organizations like the army, it takes 2 or 3 days till they get out there. And they got out there and they did a very huge impact. But it took them 3 days. This is a hospital. This is how it looks. They had a shul in the hospital. And here our teams are working together once the Israeli delegation comes. One unique thing in that was that I would like to finish. After a week, when we decided we're going back to Israel, we got a phone call from some lady in Canada saying that her husband is in the Montana Hotel, and she thinks he died, and she wants us to check what to do. And we spoke with the Israeli delegation, and we asked them to go together to the Montana Hotel. And they said, listen, we can't go between the rubble because it's very, very dangerous. So we decided to leave a team there for a couple of weeks. And after a couple of weeks, Baruch Hashem, we took out the remains and brought them to the family. And I think that us as Zaka, the IDF, a lot of Jewish organizations around the world sometimes don't realize when something big happens, what a big impact we have for the world. And it's very, very important. Even now with the big story that happened in Turkey, I'm not talking about the political issues that Israel has with Turkey, but Turkey did want to learn from the Israeli skills. Thank you very much.
I think we have a few minutes for some questions. If you have any questions, can you come?
Is there a difference between the notion of Mishum Eva, that we help non-Jews because we're concerned about being hated, and Mishum Darkei Shalom? So I think that if there are two perspectives on Darkei Shalom. The first perspective that looks at it as a more of a defensive posture, I think really uses Mishum Eva, Mishum Darkei Shalom interchangeably. However, the approach of other Rishonim, which I clearly demonstrate in the handout that I gave, especially crowned by the Rambam, would really would bifurcate those two issues. And clearly when the Gemara means Mishum Darkei Shalom, there's nothing to do with Eva, but rather serving as that junior partner with the Kadosh Baruch Hu.
I'm not going to repeat the question, it's too long, but I'll answer. Also the IDF and also us, when you go into a very big disaster, there's all kind of layers of response, okay? And most of the teams around the world are in layer A, which means you got to give a response from the time that the event happened until 3 weeks. After 3 weeks is the Red Cross and the USA and all kind of those big things. So when you go out from the first place, you know that the max you can go out is 3 weeks. Because that's the Zamish Bitzit Shirano, the kids.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a short break now for coffee. Let's get everybody back.
We'll be starting our next session at 3 o'clock, as was scheduled. So there's some fresh fruit outside and some other drinks. So please make it quick and come back for a very fascinating session on vaccinations, featuring Rabbi Moshe Fendler, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt, and Dr. Warren Siegel, who will be speaking about vaccinations. So thank you.